Welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast. In a week that's seen terror attacks in Germany and France, the question of the relationship between Islamic terrorism and Europe's refugee crisis is once again rearing its head. In his Spectator cover piece, Douglas Murray argues that Europe's political classes are refusing to engage with the problem at its core level. So how can we bridge this gap between what politicians are saying and what the public are thinking? And does Europe have to come to terms with the new reality of domestic terrorism? I'm joined now by Douglas Murray and Haras Rafiq, the Managing Director of the Quilliam Foundation, a counter-extremism think tank. So, Douglas, why is this the summer of terror?
Well, it's got off to a pretty big start in that regard. As I've said on the Spectator website a number of times, you don't have to go back very many hours now to find the latest attack in Europe. And the accumulation of these attacks, I think, is going to have a very profound effect on European politics.
I mean, it's been shocking how many attacks there have been in the last few days. Is this just something Europeans are going to have to start getting used to, Harris?
This is the new reality. I mean, we've talked about, banged on about, the global jihadist insurgency now for years, and largely on deaf ears. People didn't want to know, people wanted to look the other way, and this is the reality. This is the way life is going to be now for a while until we collectively get our act together and sort this problem out. There still seems to be a reluctance. I saw something in the news today that President Hollande has had a meeting with faith leaders. Mm. What's that going to do? Are they going to pray for peace? I must admit, until the attack yesterday, somebody who's been doing this for a number of years now, like Douglas, got a bit of jihadist terrorism fatigue. You know, an attack, okay, it's become the normal. Yeah. But yesterday, what happened in Normandy really is for the first time in 12 years, and I'm afraid.
And is that because of the religious element to it?
For me, it's the target, it's a selection of target. I mean, in the past, you know, there have been people from Jewish traditions that have been targeted because they are politically Zionist, blah, 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 or whatever they want to go on about. Then they've picked on people they considered blasphemers, and then now they've actually declared a war on Christianity. This is the attack, the war on Rome, that people like Baghdadi, Bin Laden...
And I mean, Hollande did refer to it as a war yesterday, didn't he?
Yes.
He said this is a war. How does that change things, Douglas?
Well, it doesn't change things, because, I mean, he said that for a long time, and now, every time there is an attack in France, Hollande comes out and says there's a war. I think one of the most interesting things was, and going back to what you just asked, Harris, was that the Prime Minister in France, Manuel Valls, said after Nice that France might have to get used to terrorism. And a lot of people reacted very badly to that statement. I thought it was, in some ways, refreshingly frank, because Valls is not wrong. That although you can limit the ability of people to get hold of Kalashnikovs and explosives, it's extremely hard to limit people's access to knives or trucks. And so you do have to warn the public, actually. You do have to tell them this is something which, apart from anything else, because there is a tendency always to turn on the people who are protecting us instead of the people attacking us. So you hear people criticizing the French authorities for not stopping Nice or not stopping Rouen. So there are always criticisms to be made. There are always what might have beens. But it is very hard, I say this in my cover piece, it is very hard to imagine a scenario where the church in Rouen yesterday could have been protected.
You know, one of the things that struck me recently, having travelled to France and having been around Central Europe, is that there is still this focus, rightly, on protecting and stopping terrorist attacks. As Douglas said, how do you stop a self-starter who has been remotely radicalised, who becomes remotely operationalised? How do you stop that person? Well, you've got to do whatever you can, of course. But at the end of the day, in Europe especially, they've been focusing on containment and stopping terrorist attacks. Mm. It's a bit like treating the symptoms. It's a bit like giving the penicillin to somebody who's got a disease. What about tackling the disease? When are we going to wake up and actually provide the inoculation and tackle the disease and cure people?
I mean, this is, Harris, right, it asks exactly the core question, but I have a very bleak piece of news on this, which is that it may not be possible for Europe to solve this problem. I say that for the following reasons. and I mentioned this in the piece, the political leaders are aware of the problem of Islamism. They are very reluctant to say where Islamism comes from. The public, however, know where Islamism comes from. Islamism comes from Islam. Where does Islam come from? Islam comes most obviously from the Muslims. So, how do you simultaneously argue that a process which Germany in particular accelerated last year of importing millions of new Muslim arrivals into Europe is a wise thing to do at the same time that you have this problem already? And therein lies the political trap for our continent. Because obviously we have to keep the differentiation between ordinary Muslims who abhor such acts as Rouen yesterday and though that minority that might find some sympathy or that tiny minority who might do it. Yet at the same time, the more people who come into the continent who are of Muslim background, the more numbers will be vulnerable to that. And that is the problem, that we have to continue to exercise our judiciousness about this and not try to lump everyone into a basket, whilst admitting the Islamism comes from the Muslim community. And the French Prime Minister and the French President and no other European leader can solve that problem for Islam.
Yeah, it's essentially, you know, there are people who are reluctant around the world to admit where the problem comes from. There are people who say this has got nothing to do with Islam, and then there are people that say this is all of Islam. The reality is it has got something to do with Islam. It comes, the justification does come from, and we have to be honest, as Muslims, I'm a Muslim, we have to be honest and face up to that. The good news is that more and more Muslims are starting, but the bad news, it's not fast enough at this moment in time. There needs to be a reform, a process of reform within the Muslim traditions, going back to the old traditions of Islah and Ijtihad. That's a key component that's missing, and until our political leaders wake up to the fact that they need to empower and they need to put in place processes and strategies whereby this civil war that's taking place within Islam, because essentially this is what this is. This is not new. This has been going on for a while. It just raises its head in a different name. There's a civil war going on within Islam. Muslims need to sort it out. It's spilling over the streets. Muslims are being killed as well as non-Muslims. But going back to the point Douglas made, one of the things, I mean, fine, you know, we're talking about migration, etc., but the majority of the people that have been carrying out these attacks in Europe are homegrown, people that are born in the region. Before we even start looking at what we do with people, whether we stop them coming in or not, that's a different discussion, we need to fix the problem at home. That's what we could not get into grips
but
with.
But it isn't a different discussion. It is part of exactly the same discussion. Europe has not been able to assimilate the Muslims who have already come here. Some, yes, but a lot, no. So it is madness to, at the same time you have failed to assimilate the Muslims already here, bring in millions of more Muslims from the most war-driven parts of the world. It is madness. The Christians of the Middle East know how this plays out. They know how this plays out. Christians in France will be now learning how this plays out. And the numbers matter because, as I say, the most striking thing in this whole story is as follows. Islam is going through this long civil war. We don't know who wins. But Europe cannot put its own future, the European peoples cannot put our own future in the hands of that civil war. It's always been my belief that we have to, as much as we can, inoculate ourselves from this war. But we cannot, as Europeans, decide if the good Muslims do not win, then Europe dies. And this is not in our power.
Yes, Douglas has a point on, do we import more of this potential? You know, let's say that a small percentage of the people that we take on as refugees, etc., maybe from this worldview. But the bigger danger is even before then. You go to Belgium, you go to Germany, you go to places like that. Not only are they, why I said immigration or refugee is a different conversation, before we even get to that, they're importing Salafi, jihadi theology into their countries. You go to Brussels. Brussels has already said virtually to countries in the Middle East, here, have Islam in Brussels. And we're getting that kind of Islam already. So even without the immigrants and without the refugees, we're importing that aspect of religion already.
Absolutely. And that has to also be tackled. If they are serious about this, Europe's leaders, then they tackle that now as well. But just one other point on this. I think that something which has not been borne in mind enough about since the attack in Rouen is this. You'll remember that we started off with Harris mentioned the Charlie Hebdo attacks in January 2015. One of the saddest responses to the Charlie Hebdo attacks, which were almost unanimous in the abhorrence towards them, Pope Francis condemned the attacks, of course, on Charlie Hebdo, but also said, you know, he famously, if somebody insults my mother, you know, they can expect a punch. Actually, from a man of God and a representative of what is meant to be a very peaceful religion, and whose founder certainly was very peaceful, this was a very retrograde comment. However, I'm not mentioning that to pick a fight, as it were, 18 months on. What I would suggest is this. 18 months now between the attacks on one of the most rollicking, joyously atheist, secularist magazines, perhaps the only one, anti-racist magazines in Europe. The epitome of free speech and liberté and so on. 18 months later, a French priest massacred at the altar by exactly the same ideology. This should be a moment, I would suggest, for Catholics, for secularists, for atheists, for liberal Muslims, for all sorts of people to come together and say, this is enough, yeah. And this is a very clear enemy. It kills the secularists of Charlie Hebdo, and it kills the priest during the Eucharist. What clearer sign could there be, and what greater coalition could you get to unite against this barbarism and snuff it out once and for all?
That was Douglas Murray and Haras Rafiq. Next, the Republicans held their national convention in Cleveland last week, where they swore in Donald Trump as their candidate. Meanwhile, the Democratic Party was rocked by the leak of 20,000 private emails. The emails undermine the Democrats' process for selecting Hillary Clinton as their candidate, while the leak itself has been linked to Russian hackers. So what impact will these revelations have on the election? And should the public be concerned by Donald Trump's rather friendly relationship with Russia and Vladimir Putin? Joining us from Washington is Anne Applebaum, who argues unequivocally in this week's magazine that the goal of the leaks is to disrupt the American election and elect Donald Trump as president. I'm also joined by The Spectator's deputy editor, Freddie Gray. So, Anne, your theory is that Russians were involved in the DNC email leak. Can you explain why that is?
It's not really a theory. It's the sum of what's known to date about the DNC hack. A number of companies have examined what happened. They've looked through the material, and they find all kinds of signs on the malware that was used inside the DNC servers that link it back to Russia, including Russian, you know, Cyrillic writing and all kinds of other things. And actually, this story has been around for a while. I think we've known since June, at least it's been public since June, that there was a Russian hack of the DNC server. And it seems that the DNC itself knew it before that. I was told about it a couple of months ago. So it's not really new, and it's not really surprising. It's also not surprising given what we know about how the Russians now operate in other democratic countries during other democratic elections. This is now a pattern of the Russians either introducing hacked information or emails or taped conversations into a democratic election, you know, particularly at a high moment of when it's very important, and in an attempt to change the debate. And sometimes they've succeeded and sometimes they haven't. But it's now absolutely established that this is what they do. And they've done it in multiple countries, particularly in Central and Eastern Europe. And I have to say, I'm surprised they attempted it in the US, but they've done it.
And Freddie, how do you think this is going to play out if it starts to be seen that the Russians are getting involved in the US election?
Well, I mean, I suppose it's no real surprise that Russia supports Donald Trump. I mean, it makes perfect sense from a sort of national interest point of view, from their perspective. Hillary Clinton has been much more belligerent over the Ukraine towards Russia. And Donald Trump takes every chance he can to say what a great guy he thinks Putin is. So if this can be established as true, then I think it hurts Trump quite badly. However, at the moment, it is a lot of smoke and not very much fire. And the Democrats need to be a little bit careful because, of course, Hillary Clinton's Clinton Foundation has some extremely dodgy funding from terrible governments all over the world.
The difference is that the unusual thing about the Trump campaign is that it's already intervened in several really quite striking ways on policy towards Russia. So in U.S. campaigns before the convention, there's always a platform put together. And it's usually there's usually a lot of debate about what should be in the platform and different people have issues they care about. This time, the Republican Party was more or less allowed to do the platform as it wished. And the Trump campaign, in other words, Trump's people, were really only interested in one issue. And the issue they were interested in was a pretty minor one in the American political spectrum, which is exactly the interest of you is the subject of Ukraine and the language about Ukraine and Ukrainian sovereignty. And the Trump campaign really cared about it. They made a point of changing it. That's the one element of the platform that you can definitely attribute to Trump and his campaign staff. And that's pretty unusual.
Yes.
And can I just ask, how much do you think this is Paul Manafort's involvement and how much can we prove that it is?
Well, I mean, it was Paul Manafort. I mean, there's no need to prove anything.
But that he'd be acting as a sort of Russian operative for Trump.
There's no deceit. There's no deception. There's no secrets. You know, Paul Manafort worked in, this is for those who don't know, Paul Manafort is Trump's campaign manager. And he spent most of the last decade in Ukraine working for Viktor Yanukovych, who was the pro-Russian Ukrainian president. He's the one who escaped the country in 2014 after the Maidan Revolution. He was profoundly corrupt. And also, he used these kinds of campaign tactics. I mean, the disinformation, hacks, leaks, fake news stories. I mean, these are Ukrainian election tactics that were used by Paul Manafort in Ukraine for the last decade, and now they're in operation here. So we're in an unusual position where the head of an American political campaign's most striking and most important previous political commitment was in a foreign country, and it was for a dictatorial government. And so that's different, you know, from previous campaigns. And so it's not really a question of saying, well, you know, it's some conspiracy theory and there's a lot of smoke. I mean, this is all in the open. There's nobody questioning this or doubting it, that this is the case.
Isn't it a worry, though, that even for among sort of fairly sort of sensible conservatives in America, that the levels of paranoia have reached such a great extent that nobody's able to look at the more obvious, broader picture?
I don't think, if you mean paranoia about Russia, I don't think it's very high at all.
No, I mean paranoia about the sort of the neoliberal West and Hillary Clinton.
Oh, in that sense, yes. Well, yes, I do think there's in a way, you know, you can forgive the broader American public for not being focused on the issue of who is Paul Manafort and what did he do for Viktor Yanukovych. Mm. You know, but the stranger thing is the Republican Party, which has a long, solid history of being involved in American foreign policy and of understanding the world. There are many people who work for it, who've held jobs and important jobs in the national security apparatus. The fact that the party is so silent about this and so little involved in criticizing what's going on, that's really shocking to me.
And Anne, obviously Russia's a kind of great force in reactionary politics at the moment. Do you think we could actually see a Trump-Putin alliance if Trump gets the presidency?
I don't think there's really any question that we will. As Freddie said a few minutes ago, I mean, first of all, there are his public statements in support of Putin. Second of all, there's more and more evidence that many of his companies are funded by Russian money. Trump has a terrible record of defrauding people, and so he can't get loans from American banks. And so he's had a lot of influx of money from Russia, from Kazakhstan, from the post-Soviet world. And, you know, this, of course, is the kind of thing the Russians love. You know, they love being involved with people whose dirty secrets they know and, you know, whose business operations they understand. I mean, in a certain sense, Trump is a very post-Soviet politician. What are post-Soviet politicians? They're corrupt, fraudulent businessmen who are trying to win political power in order to keep their companies going and in order to mix political and economic influence. This is exactly what Trump is. And we've never really had a politician like this in America before. And I think that's why, in some senses, why he's so confusing. You know, people don't have the framework to put him in. You know, they don't see him in the context of other politicians like him in other countries who attain power and wealth in this fashion.
That was Anne Applebaum and Freddie Gray. And finally, the beating sun that's dogged Britain for the past week seems to have finally given way to reliably greyer skies. But much as the British love to discuss the weather, we're rather bad at predicting it. the Met Office has been criticised for providing less reliable data than their American or European counterparts. I'm joined by Ariane Chourine, who writes in this week's magazine about the challenges posed to British meteorologists. So, Ariane, why are the British so bad at predicting weather?
Apparently we don't have enough data. To the extent that American and European forecasters provide us with more accurate forecasts than the Met Office. So the Met Office are now asking amateur meteorologists to buy these £60 weather stations and put them in their gardens or their car to provide them with more data to enable more accurate predictions.
And in your piece you mentioned climate change and say that we probably shouldn't be so worried about climate change given that we can't even predict when there's going to be a shower outside.
Well, yeah, I think that's looking on the sunny side. You know, to say that if we can't even tell what it's going to be like tomorrow, whether it's going to be sunny or rainy, then hopefully these predictions for 30 years in the future won't be accurate either.
There are places like Norway that I know do, and you know, there are other places like America that have really good weather apps. Is it just that the weather's actually pretty boring and actually there's not a huge amount to predict anyway?
Well, I think that we do have four seasons here. We definitely experience four seasons, whereas some areas like California, for instance, it is more likely to be sunny every day. So perhaps that's a part of it.
And obviously, I mean, British love complaining about weather. Is this just another aspect of it that we like complaining about? Our weather forecasts as well.
Yes, and I think it provides us with a handy topic of conversation, whereas a lot of the time we don't talk to each other. When we're on public transport, you know, we look away, even if we're kind of sandwiched really close to each other. Whereas if it's tipping it down outside a train or outside, you know, a bus window, then that provides us with a fantastic opportunity for conversation. And the only thing that's comparable for me was when I had a baby and people could talk about the baby. But a lot of the time Brits are so awkward that we really don't know what to talk about.
Well, last time we wrote something about the Met Office, I just looked it up and they got a bit annoyed about it and actually wrote a blog about why the Spectator was wrong. And their main argument seemed to be that you can't be accurate 100% of the time about the weather,
right,
which they clearly weren't. But I mean, do you think there's an argument that they get it right most of the time and that's fine, or for some people in the north of England they'll be getting an accurate forecast but down here we're not? Does that matter?
Yes, that's perfectly possible, I would say, in the interests of dissuading them from writing another blog about it. It's also a sort of philosophical lesson to us that we can't control things 100% of the time. I mean, I say in my piece that Kim Jong-un and also Stalin, so two communist leaders, are both very, very concerned with wanting to predict the weather. I mean, Stalin especially purged all the meteorologists in 1933 because of their inaccurate weather predictions. And obviously the Met Office are not under this amount of pressure. you know, there's still the onus on them to predict things correctly. And people do, I mean, they lost their contract last year and it was to no fault of their own. The BBC were legally obliged to put it out to tender for other forecasters. And weirdly, the Met Office still provide the majority of the data to these forecasters, so they're the kind of unacknowledged middleman, but it's still their job to do that, so it's no wonder that they get a little bit defensive.
I mean, I always think they're quite good at predicting, you know, we know when there's gonna be a big heat wave or if there's a massive storm coming or there's a snowstorm coming. I feel like we get a good sense of when that sort of thing is happening, which seems quite major. But it seems that people actually want kind of minutiae detail about what hour is going to be raining and when the sun's going to peek through. Is it just that we're getting kind of slightly obsessive about the weather and actually we should just chill out and not worry so much?
Well, I was speaking to somebody earlier who's a gardener and who said that they wouldn't get the hose pipe out if they didn't have to. And of course, it's very helpful to know for gardening and whether you want to put the laundry out or whether you're unable to put the laundry out because it's going to get wet. Also, if you have a child, as I do, you know, you don't want them to freeze in a vest when it's going to be really cold, or you don't want them to get wet when it's predicted to be sunny. So it's understandable that people do get a little bit antsy about it, I think.
I think people just quite like sort of being told this is what's going to happen today, even if it doesn't pan out that way. They like that kind of sense of structure, don't they?
They like that certainty. And I think maybe it is a lesson that we can't always have certainty in all areas of our lives. So carry a brolly and wear multiple layers.
That was Ariane Shireen on predicting the weather. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. If you enjoy the podcast, why not try out the magazine? You can pick up a copy of the most provocative magazine in Britain, and we have a new trial offer for podcast listeners. Get 12 issues for just £12 by visiting spectator.co.uk/12. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.